From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nambi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspaper. Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Also joining us in studio this hour is Muriel Bowser. She is the mayor of the District of Columbia. Mayor Bowser, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. Thank you for having me.
If you have questions or comments for Mayor Bowser, you can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream, ask a question, or make a comment there. Call us at 800-433-8850, send email to kojo@wamu.org, or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Metro General Manager Paul Wiedefeld just got through a press conference that started at 11 o'clock this morning, in which he introduced his Safe Track plan. It includes weekend closures at midnight Friday and Saturday, moratorium on extended hours. The system will close at midnight 7 days a week. No more extended hours for events, etc. Early openings or late closing. Safety surges, long duration outages on select lines and segments. He will be our guest here on the Kojo Nambi Show on Monday. But first, Tom Sherwood, what do you make of this?
Well, you know, some political leaders in this region said we needed to change a change agent at Metro, someone who would come in and shake up the system.
Turnaround special.
A turnaround special. I don't know, some of those politicians might be in the room. So if you don't mind, I will ask our guest.
Defer.
Mayor Bowser, you were among the people who said we can't do the same old, same old.
And she's a former member of the Metro Board.
Well, she was on the board. Some people have criticized her. We won't get to that. The point is, people said Metro has got to do something. What's your reaction to Paul Wiedefeld's plan today?
Well, I am going to look at it with great interest. I'm going to follow all of the details, but I will tell you on a very high level, I think that the general manager is right to attack this problem with urgency. We cannot ignore the fact that we have a system that is not near as safe as it needs to be, and we're having repeated incidents that bear that out. So I'm heartened by the fact that we will have service. Though lower service in some cases, closed stations or parts of the line that will be down. But I think that it is incumbent upon all of us to figure out, and I know that he laid out in his press conference a schedule that will give the riding public the ability to plan around that work.
And just as importantly, for you as the mayor of the city and DDOT, and for the county traffic people and the state transportation people, you also have to plan. I've already been on the soapbox about terrible traffic in the city, which I could do a whole hour on, but it seems to me that
people want to be here, Tom. So yes, the more I know, people that want to be here, the more traffic we have.
And we have to accommodate them better than we do now. But it does seem to me you will gear up your administration to help with the transportation with traffic control.
Absolutely.
And all whatever, and bus issues.
Absolutely. So keep in mind that I had a call with Paul late last evening. My members of the board were briefed with the other board members earlier today. So we're going to really want to examine what's proposed here in the schedule. So that you're right, that Metro obviously operates most buses in Washington, D.C., and we operate some, but to the extent that we can make bus movements easier, prioritized, or in other ways to help people get around, we're going to do exactly
even
that.
Even maybe temporary bus lanes only. Because you've talked about maybe trying to move to some rapid bus transit in the city.
Well, we have. We have one that we opened a short distance on Georgia Avenue. We've also moved the process or the planning process along for bus lanes on 16th Street.
And it should be mentioned that Paul Wiedefeld says shuttle buses will serve closed stations. Transit service will be maintained at all times, although service levels may be reduced significantly. Tom, to what extent do you think that we in news will continue to focus on the inconvenience that this causes to riders?
Oh, we'll give it incredible attention. You know, the media is not your friend. The media does point out things, and we look, you know, we ask people what you know, if something good happens, it gets less coverage often. But part of our job is to hold officials accountable and to tell what it's like out on the street. So if you go to a crowded metro platform where people are fearful of falling off or not getting up broken escalators, that's going to be the news. And the mayor, you know this as a politician, you can do 10 good things, and the one thing that didn't quite make it is the headline. So I think that's where we'll be. It is a region, though. It is a regional problem. And I might add, for Secretary Fox at Transportation and some political people on Capitol Hill, it's a congressional problem, too, about how Metro works for the nation's capital and the nation's capital region. I think I just stole words from the mayor.
No, but people should expect, and I should say this, people should expect safe and reliable transportation from our public transportation system. And it does indeed serve the entire region. And we need it to work, and we need it to work well. So these emergency actions are necessary. We want to make sure, and I think Paul has had several months to really give it a good look and put his attention to the best way to plan it. But as I understand it, he is going to be able to, with these changes, get work that might have taken several years done in the 12 months that the plan covers.
We ought to see this as when everyone was just delighted when Metro started opening in the 1970s. We ought to see this as the rebirth of Metro. We are creating Metro again on the rail system. And that's the way it ought to be looked at, not as something that somebody's going to be doing with as least interruption as possible.
And it's going to call for some sacrifice on the part of passengers, because you and I remember when Metro was being built. I was living in the Shaw neighborhood on 8th Street Northwest. It called for a great deal of sacrifice for us residents and for businesses in that area. But ultimately,
some of which went out of business.
Exactly. Ultimately, it became a boon to the whole
area.
You
mentioned the media. We'll be watching what the elected leaders do.
Very carefully. Mayor Bowser, perhaps your biggest initiative to date, replacing the city's homeless shelter at DC General with a network of smaller shelters, one in every ward, has hit some snags, including questions about costs and transparency around how sites were chosen. Council Chair Phil Mendelson is reworking the plan to address some of those concerns. What's he looking at, Tom?
Oh, I thought you asked the mayor a question about that. Well, I did that story. It got bumped out by some of this Metro stuff, but the chairman told me that he's concerned about the high cost. The chairman said has indicated that maybe you could save some costs by moving some of these. They're not shelters. This is temporary homes. These are homes where families can live rather than the squalor of D.C. General. And that these can be built maybe on some D.C. land to cut this cost by tens of millions of dollars and cut out some of the profit motive that is in there by going to private lands.
Mayor Bowser, he will present his version to the council in June. Are you willing to consider other options?
Well, this is a legislative process, Kojo. You know, I was a member of the legislature for over 8 years, and legislation gets tweaked all the time. I think that the chairman and I dare say the entire council, share the same goal, and that's to close D.C. General and to do it just as soon as possible. And also to make sure that we are treating this issue of ending family homelessness as a citywide issue, because it is a citywide issue. So the plan that we have presented to the council does exactly that. So I have a conversation with the chairman every week. I ask him what his thoughts are on these things, and I'm looking forward to him sharing those thoughts.
That means he hasn't shared these thoughts with the mayor. But I will say this, he was very upset that the News 4 found out about this idea. And I know the city administrator, Rashad Young, paid him a visit yesterday afternoon, and they had a firm conversation. But
Phil
does say he agrees with you. The chairman says he agrees. He says the whole council agrees with you about dispersing the homes.
Well, I think it's important because, you know, this is tough. These are tough. You know, I was a ward council member, so I know what some of the ward council members are dealing with. But it is also going to take some courage and leadership on everybody's part. This is a situation where, you know, I hope that we're into the negotiation phase with the council members and not just the no phase, because if we can talk about some specifics, like if they don't like what we have proposed, do they have a specific site that they're willing to stand behind, put their name behind, go to the community and talk about, then we have something to work with.
The chairman also told me that he did intend to have a vote in the council before the end of June, before the summer recess, which is a couple of months later. And I've seen this. You'll be running for re-election in 2018. And you want to close DC General that year. I can see a situation.
No, I want to close D.C. General this year. If I could close D.C. General this year, I would. If I could close it next year, I would. The fastest that we can close it on the timeline that we're on now is 2018. But I will say this, Tom, if the council delays too much longer, and I don't want to say that they're dragging their feet because this takes some time, but if they delay too much beyond their recess, I don't know that we'll hit any of those timelines.
I can see a campaign where you will very politely but firmly in 2018 or maybe late 2017 point your finger at the D.C. Council and say, this was my plan and you didn't get it done fast enough, and so therefore when D.C. General is still open, it's your fault, not mine.
Well,
but you don't want to get there.
I have more faith in all of us than that, and so I'm going to push as hard as I can because I think the families that are in D.C. General now deserve it. The families who will experience emergencies in the coming years deserve it, and that's important. The last thing I'll say is that if there is an alternate plan about some use of public land, we have to make sure that the council then funds it. Our plan is funded on a mix of some owned sites and some lease sites that stretch over the years. And so if we are to move to a different way of doing things on D.C. government land, then we would also have to have the capital dollars to make the construction happen.
The chairman told me that the funding hasn't been presented to the council. Is that correct? You have it, but you haven't presented it to the council?
We wouldn't present it until we present our FY18 budget when the cost hit.
D.C. Trust, otherwise known as the D.C. Children and Youth Investment Trust Corporation, an organization which supported more than 70 programs for at-risk youth, has had a troubled history, but last week we learned that the trust is essentially bankrupt and will be dissolved, at least in part because of lavish salaries, misuse of credit cards, and sky-high overhead. As mayor, you control 4 seats on the board. Why was no one looking closely at spending in an organization that had such a troubled history? And how did the trust receive a clean financial audit less than a year ago?
Well, that's a question for the auditors that I have. But I've had a couple of experiences now where auditors gave a clean report, and it turned out to be some shenanigans going on. Not so clean. And I would say that our deputy mayor, who serves on the board now, started to ask some questions about overhead costs, for example, when we were thinking about sending some funds, and we did to the trust to issue some mini grants. And I think what we've learned is there's just a fundamental structural problem at the trust, that the government sends money for grants, but they can't afford the overhead, so they had been using some of the grant monies to support their overhead. Now, I think that some of these things were probably known back in, I guess that was 2013, when some other problems were discovered with the trust, but people, and I think good-heartedly, wanted to make sure that we had a nimble entity that could get the youth funds out. I personally am not willing to kind of prop up that structure, which we know is flawed.
This is the D.C. Trust is the organization from which Harry Thomas Jr. stole $350,000.
Former Ward 5 council member.
But this also is the politics hour. This is a developing political issue between former Mayor Gray and Yvette Alexander, with Gray's campaign suggesting Alexander has not done enough to look
due
over
diligence in her oversight.
Right. Thank you very much for those words.
I believe
you're supporting the incumbent. Ms. Alexander, do you think this will have any effect on that Ward 7 race?
Well, I think there's probably enough to talk about the former mayor and what his role in oversight was. You asked me about my appointees to the board. There were appointees there, when I got there. And also I believed that the former mayor brought in the executive director who didn't actually fix the problem but may have exacerbated the problem.
Spending money on himself.
I think there is a lot of discussion that's left to be had. I think that the council member, Alexander, is going to have a hearing about it. My deputy mayor in January sent this issue to the inspector general when we learned about the misuse of funds. So I think there's some investigation to be had. What we think now is that the funds and the kind of the structure of the organization was flawed and has been flawed.
It's $100 million since 1999 when it was set up under Mayor Tony Williams. And a lot of people have depended on this for real services. So I hope that everyone gets it straightened out.
Well, let me say this. I think there's some confusion out there from the grantees that somehow their grants aren't going to come through. And we want to make perfectly clear that we're trying to sort things out with the current director, who is brought in only a couple of months ago. And we have found her to be very responsive. And she is working out how to disperse the remainder of the grant funds.
Our guest is Mayor Muriel Bowser of the District of Columbia. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream there. Send us a tweet at Kojo Show. The council is backing away from a proposal to pay people likely to commit crimes to stay out of trouble. Kenyon McDuffie, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, essentially blames you for failing to fund the crime bill that he said the council spent months putting together. This initiative in treating gun violence as a public health emergency was the centerpiece of that bill. Where, therefore, is there agreement between you and the council on addressing
crime? The council can fund whatever it wants to fund. So if the Judiciary Committee failed to fund the Judiciary Committee chairman's issue, then I think that's where you should toss that question.
Well, there you go. That is, you know, there's the politics hour answer to that issue.
However, it's my understanding that you have a proposal of your own that would do kind of something similar, what the council member
was submitted to the council what we believed was a comprehensive set of initiatives called Safer Stronger. It included making sure we're retaining police officers and deploying them in the areas that it most needs. It included additional money for our crime lab. It included funding for security cameras. It included enhancements to penalties for crimes committed on Metro. It also would have given us the ability to hold people who were facing trial in certain circumstances. So that was our alternative. And I think that the committee ended up moving on some of the things, but decided not to move on most of the package. And frankly, I think a number of the council members did not know in the public safety bill that they voted on that they were voting on stipends to be paid to people with very little, you know, requirements of them in return. So what we have focused on, even in our supplemental of last year, was having a jobs program called Career Connections that would allow us to hire young people, especially court-involved young people that have the most barriers to employment and get them employed. They require a lot of assistance, but they do have the requirement to give back to work. So it's not a stipend, it's a paycheck. And it's a paycheck for coming in, getting trained, and getting job ready.
This is the plan that Kenyon McDuffie was interested in. It comes out of Richmond, California, I believe.
Correct.
And I think we ought to be clear, it is not to just simply pay people for them to sit on the front steps and not commit crimes, although I can see in a campaign how that could be characterized that way. But it is to pay them and then enroll them in various programs. And the mayor, as I understand it, says we're already essentially doing that in many ways.
We do have a number of programs that the council funded, and we appreciate the Judiciary Committee and the chairman of the council on being very supportive of Career Connections. And that's how we want to go.
Do you think Kenyon McDuffie will be is maneuvering to be a candidate against you in the next election for mayor?
I really have no idea who's going to be in the campaign against me. I'm going to be in it, and we're going to work hard every day to make sure we have moved our city forward on the promises that we've made.
I'll take that as a yes.
You seem to be getting along better with Carl Racine.
I get along just great with everybody, Tom. Thank you very much.
On to the telephones. Please don your headphones, please. So let's go to Dana in Washington, D.C. Full disclosure here. I'm pretty sure this is Dana Priest of the Washington Post. Hi, Dana. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you for taking my call. And it is Dana Priest from the Washington Post. And I wanted to ask about Metro, Because from the beginning of the problems that we've heard about Metro, I keep thinking about the Homeland Security Department, which was funded at the tune of tens of billions of dollars by Congress after 9/11 to make cities throughout the United States safe from terrorism, and including at the top of that list was New York and Washington, D.C. So you would think that they would have spent some of that money to make Metro, which is going to be a primary evacuation route for everybody, safe and secure. And as we know, they've funded a lot of crazy things as well. My question is, has the Department of Homeland Security helped fund a better Metro? And have you considered applying and asking for their help in funding Metro?
Mayor Bowser.
Well, I won't know the exact level of funding off the top, but as I recall, I think a lot of Homeland Security dollars were focused on communications and improving communications in the tunnels. I would really have to check on other grants, because a lot of those grants were to make our systems more resilient. You're exactly right.
But across the federal government, you agree with Chairman Jack Evans and others who say that Metro, that the federal government has put in pennies for capital construction, but has done nothing for the operation of the system, even though the federal government here depends on it for its workforce.
Well, not just that, but we are unique in that we host a lot of national events as the capital city. We host a lot of visitors. We had 19 million visitors to the city last year, and many of them are coming because of our wonderful monuments and museums. So there is a significant federal interest in the Metro that is different from any system in the country. So they have given some money towards the Capitol, and we know that we're going to need more. And Jack is right to point that out. Metro, we pay them $330 million a year, which is larger than most agencies of the D.C. government. And part of this plan, you probably heard the general manager say, he doesn't know what the revenue impacts are going to be on this one-year plan. So we may be asked to do even more next year. In fact, Jack came to Chairman Evans came to the council and told us that he thought in FY18 they would be asking us for an additional $80 million in operating dollars.
See, when she talks about him on the council, she calls him Jack. When she talks about him on Metro, she calls him Chairman.
Well, that's correct. But let me just, here's my idea, because get the federal government involved. Mr. Wedderfield said today that this cutting back on track time would be suspended during the inauguration. I think we should do the opposite. We should announce to the federal government that for the 2 weeks around the inaugural, we're going to shut down Metro to save money and let them figure out how to get these millions of people around.
Well, we won't be doing that.
I know you won't.
Nor will we do it on July the 4th or some of the other high demand periods where we're moving thousands and thousands.
Congress doesn't act unless it's pushed.
All right. And so, but I think that you are also speaking to what I as mayor and all the members of the council have to think about. How are we going to deal with an $80 million bill? How are we going to deal with if they come back and tell us that we need hundreds of millions of dollars over the next 5 to 10 years to deal with this infrastructure? And so we as a government have to be nimble in working with our partners in Virginia and Maryland to make that commitment.
D.C. statehood. It's my understanding the new Columbia Statehood Commission is unveiling a draft of a new constitution for the district later today. You have proposed a three-step process. What is that path to statehood, and why now?
Well, what we're doing, Kojo, is we're just kind of pushing, instead of waiting for the Congress to act on the legislation that the Congresswoman has introduced many, many, many years over, we are getting, you know, our package together and ready to petition the next administration and the new Congress in January. So what we will do is we will ask the voters to, you know, affirm their desire for statehood, and in doing so, approve a constitution and the boundaries for the new state of New Columbia.
There's concern even among some statehood supporters that, well, we've been there before. We've seen this movie before, and no matter what happens in November's election, there's zero chance of getting this approved in Congress. What's different this time around?
I think what's different, and I've told people a lot, first of all, and since 1982, when this was last on the ballot, so many people have engaged in the statehood conversation in Washington, D.C., and they want to be a part of it. I also think that many of us are hopeful that the political winds will change. And when they do, we want to have a contemporary vote and constitution for a president and Congress. Who will push it forward.
What has Donald Trump, now the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, I don't know that he's ever said anything about statehood. I don't know if anyone's ever asked him. I know John Kasich had been asked, and he said he wasn't for it. But he said he would consider voting rights for the city. Why don't you call up Mr. Trump when he comes to visit his hotel and ask him, in case he happens to be president?
Well, what the governor from Ohio said was I don't think they need statehood. It's too many Democrats. And then when pressed about if there were Republicans, he said, "Well, okay, that sounds right. Fair is fair."
He gave an honest political answer.
He gave an honest political answer. And we have to start calling people out for that. Denying people access to full democracy with two senators and a voting member of the House is un-American. And we wouldn't accept that, and we don't accept that in many other ways. Why do we lay down for it when it comes to the people of the District of Columbia?
I'm taking notes here. Tom's instructions so far: shut down Metro during inauguration, call Donald Trump.
These are not instructions. They're suggestions of a citizen who's interested in his country.
I think we better go to Adam in Washington, D.C. Adam, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Good afternoon, Mayor Bowser. You have worked hard to support businesses and communities as mayor, and your community is asking you for paid family leave. I'm a student at George Washington University myself. We gathered these 750 signatures of students in support of paid family leave in Washington, D.C. If the council passes a paid family leave bill this session, will you sign it?
I don't know, because I don't know what it's going to include. I will tell you what the council introduced is not something that I would support, nor do I think that it's financially feasible for our city. So much so that our chief financial officer refused to score it because he didn't think that it could pay for what it promised. So I think there's a lot that I don't know. I talked to the one of the introducers of the bill, and we really don't know what's coming back from the council.
Thank you very much for your call, Tom.
Part of the issue is the overall idea of whether or not the District of Columbia is business friendly. In addition to paid family leave, you now are supporting minimum federal wage of $15 and raising the tip worker raise from $2.77 an hour to $7.50 by 2022, I think. Their council has supported part-time sick leave for part-time workers, a bill that would require businesses that hire part-time workers to schedule them 3 weeks in advance and pay them more if they don't. I'm told if you start ticking these things off, businesses say, "We love the District of Columbia, but at some point there's a tipping point." Are you worried about that?
I am very worried about it, and this has been part of my discussion with my friends on the council about the paid family leave proposal. I think it sent a shockwave through the community when it was introduced and the cost. So what the proposal is, as I understand it, is that there would be a 1% tax levied on businesses to pay for. And some jurisdictions do it. It's been done differently in the jurisdictions that have adopted it. But I think that the proposal that came to the council was a significant outlier in the amount of leave that it promised and how it would pay for it. What I suggested to the council, to your point, was that we have a competitiveness task force that looked at all of these proposals and the the layering effect of all of these proposals. As we considered the universal paid leave bill that had been introduced. So I still ask the council to go that route so that we can see what the impact. Now, I firmly believe that increasing the minimum wage is what we have to do and what we need to do before anything else.
It could be like the Tax Revision Commission that Tony Williams led, which had all sides on it and came up with various proposals for changing the city's tax structure.
And that's what I would do. And as a result of that conversation, I don't think it has to go. I think that that commission lasted 18 months. Sure. I don't think a task force like this would have to last that long. But I do think it's important to analyze all of these things. Now, the reason that I feel so strongly about raising the wage to 15, because it, as mayor, I see how all of our programs collide, and none of them will be successful if people at the end of a training program, at the end of their TANF benefits, at the end of their stay in short-term family housing, don't have access to a good-paying job. There was a study that came out this week, in fact, that said how many people in this city would be impacted by raising the wage to $15.
We're running out of time. Very quickly, our guest is Mayor Muriel Bowers of the district, Mayor of the District of Columbia. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Kathy Shaliga. She is the GOP candidate in the Senate race to replace retiring Senator Barbara McCulsey. But before we go, I'd like Sarah to get her word in, because this is Sarah Shapiro, who was the one who came up with the slogan "Taxation Without Representation" this broadcast many years ago. Sarah, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you.
Hi.
I really should think up a new name, but I'm very strongly in favor of not naming the state when we become a state a new Columbia. First of all, it's illiterate. There's no old Columbia. So the illiteracy of it just bothers me terribly. Also, and more importantly, Christopher Columbus was responsible for the death and slaughter and death by disease of millions of natives here and elsewhere. And other cities and states and countries don't have the opportunity to change their names. Columbus, Ohio is not going to change its name.
We do. What would you like to be the process?
We have an opportunity to pick a name that does not honor someone who was responsible for the death of the
Understand native. That, Sarah. What would you like to be the process for selecting that name?
Well, I guess giving me some time to think about it. No, honestly, great minds can put their names to it, and the post office could even chime in. New Columbia would be NC, and we already have an NC.
Right. Okay, so allow me to have the mayor respond, because we're running out of time.
Well, Sarah's not the only person who has brought that up, and if you look at any communication from me, you will see the slogan, "We are Washington, D.C. And New Columbia dates back for a long time. So I don't know that I disagree with Sarah, and I think that it's something that we can discuss.
We have a little time to before we have to have a name.
Muriel Bowser is the mayor of the District of Columbia.
He of little faith.
I'm all for it.
Mayor Bowser, thank you so much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you, Kojo.
We didn't get to talk about the Redskins.
I'm sorry, but we don't have time left. We have another guest who's getting ready to arrive.
She's pretty interesting. I've been reading up about our next guest. I've got some interesting questions.
Well, before you get to our next guest, let's talk
about
the former D.C. delegate Walter Fontrell. A long piece in the Post today talks about the fact that he has not been here for years, and there is great concern about the state of his mental health. You have done some stories about this. He is somewhere in the Middle East. He was in Dubai. We're not sure where Walter Fontrell is now. But in addition to being the former D.C. delegate, he's a civil rights icon who is one of the closest aides of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I worry about him. I've done these stories. I've talked to Johnny Barnes, his lawyer, and I think it's maybe they're doing something they can't tell us for privacy reasons, but I think this is something the United States State Department should take and get involved in. I think the Congress should be involved. This is a former member of Congress, as you say, a civil rights icon. He's been drifting around in the Mideast and Africa and other places without any support. He abandoned his wife. His children are here. And there seems to be there's no movement to have the State Department or somebody find him. This could be a mental capacity issue. He should be brought home and given the kind of care and treatment he needs. Said he's worried about, he's being paranoid. He's also worried about bills and debts and things like that. But the issue is, this is someone should be brought home. He should be given the care he needs, and hopefully that he would be back in good spirits so he can attend the African American Museum opening in September. We can't just let him, we're going to find him dead somewhere in Dubai or somewhere else like that, and people are going to have a sad funeral for him and talk about the things
he did. We should intervene before
that
happens.
Let's intervene in his life, not praise him when he's dead.
Joining us in studio now is Kathy Schliega. She is the GOP candidate in the Senate race to replace retiring Senator Barbara Mikulski. She's the minority whip in the Maryland House of Delegates. She's a Republican representing District 7, which includes parts of Baltimore and Hartford. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This is wonderful.
You are the highest-ranking Republican woman in the Maryland State Legislature. You've been a member of the House of Delegates since 2011 and the minority whip since 2013. Last week, you won the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Senator Mikulski. In November's contest, you'll be going up against Democratic Congressman Chris Van Hollen. First, congratulations.
Thank you.
Primary victory.
Thank you so
watch
much.
Registered Democrats, however, outnumber Republicans 2-1 in Maryland. But while that may be accepted wisdom, you say it's not true that Maryland is a deep blue state. Of course, there's the very popular governor, Larry Hogan. But you say registration numbers can be misleading. How so?
Well, you can look at other states where Massachusetts, I think Republicans are outnumbered 4-5-1, yet Charlie Baker's the governor there. West Virginia has really been trending Republican, and those numbers are much higher Democrat to Republican.
All you have to say is that I want to do in the Senate what Larry Hogan has done for the state.
Absolutely.
Or do you support him, right?
That'd
be a lot simpler. But, you know, you do run against I was looking online today. The Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee doesn't list you in its list of people it intends to help. Van Hollen has a huge record in the state. If you just were in, if I were Chris Van Hollen sitting here, what would you say to him as why you should be there other than him?
Well, I would say to voters, and I have said to voters across our great state of Maryland, that if you like where Washington's headed, if you're happy with what's going on in Washington, then you want to elect Chris Van Hollen because he's been there 25 years, according to his own words.
Well, Cojo's been here so long. Should we get rid of him?
Well,
he's been here a long time.
He's not elected. I think we should elect him. Are you going to run?
No, not this time around.
I could help run your campaign.
Not this
time
around.
We need some more radio personalities on
the
Hill.
Okay, let's talk the politics of it.
But back to, the previous point, if you think that Washington is not headed in the right direction and we need some real change in Washington, then you want to put Kathy Schliega in the U.S. Senate because
get rid
I'm
of
a,
all the Republicans here,
I'm
too.
I'm a small business owner.
What
I'm
kind
a,
of business? You're in a house restoration business?
Construction.
Do you flip houses? Could you be on TV flipping houses?
That'd be fun. Yes, I'd love it. But 30 years ago, my husband and I started the business together. And we used to do mostly all commercial work, but now we have changed our business model so we can stay in business because this recession has been really, really tough on small business and ours included. So now we are doing residential work.
If you have questions or comments for Kathy Schliega, call us at 800-433-8850. Or send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream there, or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. You and some others are convinced that Maryland is trending Republican. Is that wishful thinking, or is there data outside of the election of Governor Hogan and his current popularity to back that up?
Well, obviously, you pointed it out, the last statewide election we had in 2014, a Republican won. So we have data and real facts and a governor whose favorables are over 70%. His unfavorables are 13 or 15. So he's doing a great job.
Do you think any of that's affected by the fact he's been also battling cancer?
No, I don't. I would say if you look back to December when Governor Hogan, thank the Lord, has been declared cancer free, and I know they're watching him because cancer is a serious, illness. And his favorables, I think, were like 64. And so then January, the legislature comes back, and the leadership, Democrats in leadership in Annapolis start throwing mud at him and his favorables go up to 68. And then they start throwing more mud on him and his favorables go up to 70. And his internals have him at...
Well, I think mud baths are very good for you.
I think for your skin, Well, apparently it's quite good for a Republican governor as well.
How are you going to... You know, Van Hollen has no problem. He's one of the... He's very good at raising money. Donna Edwards is a very good Democratic opponent in the primary, would not have been in the race without the Emily's List money of, I think, $3 million or whatever. I mean, she would have had a very difficult time. I don't think you have a lot of money either, do you?
I'm busy. KathyForMaryland.com. Come on.
What is your you have advisors. What is your budget? Do you think you'll raise $1 million?
Sure. Yeah, we'll be well over that. And, you know, you just point to, well, we'll go back to Larry Hogan. He was outspent 5-1 in Maryland. Jamie Raskin's race. Look at that. Congressional race right here. You know, Jamie Raskin was outspent exponentially and by both David Trone and Kathleen Matthews, and he was the victor. So while money is important,
it's not decisive.
I like that. I'm going to steal that. It's not the only factor.
Should have asked this earlier. What is the correct pronunciation of your last name?
You were doing it perfectly. Shalega. Okay.
Shalega.
Shalega. And you just call me
Polish.
Kathy. Polish. Yep. Good
Baltimore
Polish name.
From,
yes, absolutely.
You have a very lively personality. I looked at the Baltimore Sun's website and saw your editorial board interview there. And it seems to me you have a very good style. I'm just wondering how you overcome the Democratic advantage. Are you going to support your Republican nominee for president, Donald Trump?
Well, you know,
he's not the nominee yet.
He's not yet. Thank you.
When he is the nominee. He's a presumptive nominee.
Presumptive. Let's be... Okay. Yes.
Well, so. Will you presumptively support him? Paul Ryan's
like
not.
That.
Paul Ryan created a stir this week in politics by saying the House Speaker...
Governor Hogan said he's not supporting
and
him.
And Governor Hogan says, stop asking me stupid questions
about... But it's your turn now.
Donald Trump. But so, there's a stupid question. Will you support Donald Trump as a Republican nominee should he get it in Cleveland July 18th?
Well, I had previously said I trust the voters and I would support the nominee. And obviously we need to make it to Cleveland. But I would I do have some concerns about some of the things that Donald Trump has said, specifically some of the things he said about women. So, you know, I'm watching. I'm looking.
70% on a disapproval rate among women, something like that.
And as a woman, I'm concerned. About some of the things he said. So I'm watching and waiting like millions of other Americans to say, let's, you know, I think Senator Corker said something this morning as well. Let's just take a pause here
you
and watch.
The morning
I'm glad you
watch.
Said.
I do watch.
I'm
oh
glad you
goodness.
Said.
She watches Morning Joe.
I watch Morning
I'm
Joe.
I'm glad you mentioned the comments about being, mentioned about being a woman in this situation because Congresswoman Donna Edwards noted in her concession speech that Maryland is on the verge of sending an all-male delegation to Congress. You seconded that concern in a recent op-ed in the Washington Post, including chiding Democrats on their party's candidates. Talk about that.
I actually cannot believe it. I'll tell you, I am astounded. You know, if you look back since, I think it's 1973, and, you know, I think of 1973, I was a little kid, and I think stoves were avocado green and women had beehive hair in Baltimore, hun. You know, Baltimore huns had beehive hair and they wore aprons. And, you know, that was the last time we didn't have a woman representing Maryland in the Washington, D.C. delegation.
You're saying
in the
old boy network is back?
Oh, my gosh. It can't be. You know, 60% of the voters in Maryland are women in the general election. Women are making a lot more decisions for families than they did in 1973. And, you know, women have accomplished so much. I don't think we go backwards to a time where Maryland's 10 congressional delegation has no women.
Well, how do you like to do this in Congress? How do you score this? If you and Chris Van Hollen were even roughly equal in your experiences, and you may be or may not be,
oh, we're not.
Then you could say, all right, vote for me because I would bring the diversity as Donna Edwards did. She said, I'm a single African American woman, and I would be in a Senate that has none. All right, so that's the reason. But at some, what point does the voter say, well, yes, I understand the issue of whether a woman should be in the Senate or not, but Mr. Van Hollen may have more credentials than you, fairly or unfairly, had the opportunities that you haven't had, and should I vote for you who is less experienced over someone like Van Hollen who has tremendous experience?
Well, and I think...
How much does a woman-year-old count? The, well, as Donald Trump said, the woman's card, or whatever he called it.
Playing the women card?
The women card.
I think I might have that in my wallet, but it might be just on my driver's license where it says sex and it says F for female. So, you know, I think the voters will have a great opportunity to choose a path in November in the Maryland Senate election. And Maryland voters are quite independent thinkers, especially on a race of this caliber.
Are you going to have any debates? I'm coming to your debates because I think you're going to bring that Baltimore fire to Chris Van Hollen.
I think so, man. So I got that Baltimore, steelmaker grit.
Can we talk issues for a second, please?
This is the politics.
Can we talk issues?
Can we have a debate on this show?
What are your priorities?
So let's go back
to... What issues are at the top of your agenda?
But your contrast, I think let's... You know, you were saying that, and it's...
Please answer Kojo or he'll fire me.
Wait, okay, we got to go to you, and then we'll come over here. And then I'll come back. I love radio.
She's running the show already.
That's what us women do, right?
Contrast.
So our contrast is, sure, Chris Van Hollen has, you know, 25 years in Washington, D.C., as I said earlier. I have 30 years as a small business owner. And I think we need some new ideas in Washington. You know, there are some crazy ideas, good ideas, bad ideas, and there are a lot of people making laws that have no idea how that affects job creators. The best job creators are small businesses. You know what? I mean, we have loved our employees like family. You know, they need tires for their truck. We're going to loan them the money to do that and take it out of their paycheck. If you work for Target or, Northrop Grumman, they don't do that. That's the advantage of having worked for a small company. And having a small business owner making laws is important. I'll point specifically to something that just happened in Annapolis in April. We had a bill about independent contractors, and we've had quite a bit of discussion in Annapolis about the independent contractor issue. Are they employees or are they not employees? And, you know, it's been circling around construction. This time it was about nail technicians, which is interesting. But I would tell you that independent contractors are small business owners, and this is the American dream, to start your own business, to be your own boss, to be in charge of yourself. And we should be encouraging independent contractors to thrive and get those businesses off the ground. Two separate occasions, good friends of mine, Democrats in the legislature, came to me and said, Kathy, I know you're a small business owner. You understand employment issues. I want to ask you about this unemployment insurance issue that's in the fiscal note because I don't understand it. And I'm like, great, I'm happy to answer it. So let's talk about independent unemployment insurance. Who pays your unemployment insurance? Do you pay it or does your employer pay it? And both separate occasions said, oh, the employee pays it. And I said, well, no. Apparently you haven't looked at your pay stub because your employer pays that. So and it was great that they came and talked to me. I was glad to have that conversation with them, yet a little frightening that lawmakers don't understand who pays for things.
But let's just look under the, since the recession, the nation has added, I've forgotten how many millions of jobs, 707 million jobs or something like that. The economy, while it's not robust, it's certainly improved a lot since the recession of the early, well, when Obama first took office, it was going into the tank, and it's just now coming back. A lot of African Americans are not seeing their home prices go up like they are in white neighborhoods. I mean, clearly the economy is your central issue, you would say?
Absolutely. Jobs and the economy. And people's wages have been flat and frozen.
Do you support the minimum wage in the federal government going to $12 from $7.50,
$7.25? I can tell you.
Small businesses, you know, people need to be paid.
Sure, they sure do.
And aren't you glad you came?
All in favor of employment. I have created jobs, but
so yes
I will
no?
tell you this.
Yes
oh,
no,
I already said no.
Okay. So
here's,
what do you support?
Here's what I would like to ask you. What is the best job trainings program?
What should the minimum?
Let me tell you. Hold on. Do you think a 16-year-old is worth $15 an hour? That is my question. I think the best job program
might be a good job training program.
And when you put the minimum wage at $15 an hour,
I said 12.
Grocery stores, or $12 an hour, grocery stores who employ people to pick up carts in the parking lot will no longer do that. And so these young people will not get
jobs. And those young people will end up stealing those carts and selling them.
Oh, my gosh. Not in my neighborhood, sir.
Here now
that is
John.
Not the way we do business.
In Mount Airy, Maryland. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, John.
You only have about a minute, John.
All right. Really quick. Thanks for taking my call. Oh, boy, in a minute. Whew. Okay. So Senator Norman proposed, in my own senator, Senator Huff, voted favorably in committee for Senate Bill 397. And this bill does what, well, purported to do. Thankfully, it went down. Reports to do what Wall Street has wanted to do for forever, which is remove the tenancy by entirety protection, that is, special protection for married families, against collections unless the married couple asserts in court and demonstrates they are, in fact, married. And so it was really a strange shock to me to see that
question,
it was
please. Question, question.
Supported by, it's coming. By
but the time is going.
My question is this. Wall Street or family, which comes first?
Oh.
Wow. Well, that's a loaded question. Thanks for calling SB 397. I have no idea. There are literally 3,000 bills that get introduced, and I wish I could pull that one out of my hat, but I'm in the House. And
all right,
so,
then,
families or Wall Street? Families. Okay. Of course, families.
Name one thing. Literally have 40 seconds.
Name one thing that Chris Van Hollen has voted for in the Congress that you object to.
The Iran deal. Right there, the Iran deal. I think trusting Iran shows a lack of good judgment. I don't think Iran is a trustworthy partner. I think we need someone in the U.S. Senate that believes Iran is not trustworthy.
We will be hearing a lot more about that during the course of this campaign. Kathy Schelega is the GOP candidate in the Senate race to replace retiring Senator Barbara Mikulski. Kathy Schelega, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Montgomery County Police are investigating two shootings this morning, one at Montgomery Mall, where three people were shot, and one in Aspen Hill, where one person was shot. No one in custody. Police say they'll give an update. WAMU is following the story. That's it for the show today. But remember, we've got lots more for you online. 25 years ago today, Mount Pleasant was in the midst of riots. At kojoshow.org, you can find our look back at the history and legacy of the unrest from a show 5 years ago. We've made it easy for you to find it on our landing page. And if you're thinking ahead to next week, next Monday, WAMU is back in your bookstore. Taylor Burney, a producer for the show, will be at Kramer Books in DuPont Circle talking with author Beth Hahn starting at 6:30. Whatever you're up to, remember that you can listen to this show on your schedule by streaming the show online or on your favorite podcast app. However you listen, be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon. Metro's general manager, Paul Wiedefel, joins us to discuss what the plan to fix Metro's many safety and maintenance issues will mean for riders. Plus, plans for a new development in Montgomery County highlight debates over the density in the suburbs. It's all coming up Monday at noon. Until then, have a great weekend. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schrobsdorf, Taylor Burney, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Raynell Cooper. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.